Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and healthcare. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything, from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson. still love me tomorrow.
All right. Girls. And this is the last word. My name is Michael Lawson. And this is March the 18th. I hope I'm still with you because I had a problem with getting on here today because of a Skype again. I mean, they are such a major problem now. It's becoming outrageous, Skype. I'm really telling you, I just don't know. And I will be glad when we will be going to, if I can get this back on here, we will be going to YouTube very shortly. I keep saying it, but we will be going to very shortly. Now, I hope I'm trying to check here to make sure I'm getting out to you guys because it's a problem here because we couldn't get on because of Skype. It wouldn't connect. And then when we got on, I didn't know whether or not we were, this says yes, so I have no idea. Let me close this out. It said that we were, it says we were making a connection. And now I don't know. And see, I can't see unless I go into the system, which I'm trying to do it right now, and see if we can, I can't tell. And hold on, we have a guest coming here. Okay. And we are going to, I'm trying to see whether or not I have a connection with Skype or not. So if you can just hold on just a momento until I get the, what's going on here? Change the audio sound setting. Okay, yes. One, one, two. Okay, we are making a connection. Okay, gang. Now, we have, let me, I don't know if you can hear the television in the background because they are doing a major bombing in Onslaught in Odessa now, and we want to hear what's going on with the president's call to Xi Jinping, president of China. Want to know what happened with that call. And this has been an amazing week. And ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. What you, I'm going to tell you this, and I've said this before, but I'm going to go into it in a little more depth after we, as we play this thing from Mea Culpa, from Michael Cohen, and he goes into what is going on and what I have been saying for a long time, which is that this has all been set up by Donald J. Trump. This has all been set up by him. Everything you have heard and heard has been set up by Donald J. Trump. And we need to understand that this clown that we've had, who has ran amok with our government, who was here for the last 4 years. He's the one that has started this whole ball rolling. President Donald J. Trump is the one that has started everything rolling. Nobody else. He was the one that set up everything to with this war. He's the one that has set up all the all the things that has gone on with the war. Donald J. Trump. And we need to listen to him and what he has, what he said and what he has done. And Donald J. Trump, when he got into office, the main thing that he wanted to do was to get a tower in Russia, Moscow. He wanted to build a tower in Moscow. The Russians have something on this man. So part of the deal was when he became president, and if he became president, he was going to rip and tear apart NATO. He was going to put NATO to shreds. He was going to make everybody in Europe fight one another because of money that they owe, a little bit here, a little bit here. They're not paying. We're paying all the, we're not going to pay it no more. And we are all of NATO. We, the United States of America, is the one that supports NATO. Wholeheartedly, yes, yes, we do. But you know what? We need to keep the world together. We have to be the one that keeps the world together, whether you like it or not. After World War II, World War I and World War II, it was the United States that got the world back on its feet, whether you like it or not. And whether you like it or not, we are the world leaders. And without us, these people will do nothing in the entire world. In the entire world, there are no major leaders that people will follow, that countries will follow. We are the ones that they will follow. And Donald Trump's job was to destroy all that. Because Donald Trump is not an American and needs to be charged and arrested for sedition. And you're going to see it. I'm trying to explain some of it to you now. I've been trying to explain it to you for the last 2 years. The man got in there. You look at everything he's done. He first got in there. First thing he did was cancel the treaty with Iran on nuclear weapons. The second thing he did was to get rid of and start a fight in NATO because NATO wouldn't pay up. If these countries can't afford to buy shoes, and they're going to pay up, they're keeping some of the money. Yeah, there might be some daggone fraud, but they are part of the world organization. And he made that seem very, very strange. He got rid of, he broke, and he told Putin that he was going to get rid of them, and he would be sitting in the driver's seat. And Putin said, I want you to do this because I want to take back the countries that are now broken up and have their own regimes that were part of the Soviet Union. I want to bring them back. And the first country I want to bring back is Ukraine. You see, he went into Ukraine and got Crimea. And nobody said anything. This was the start of appeasement. Obama did it. And the people before Obama did it. But the problem is that the people in Europe did not want to start a war. And they were afraid that if they went in and said, no, you can't do this, World War III would start, and these people did not want it. But Russia doesn't want World War III because they would lose. We would win in World War III, but nobody wins in World War III with nuclear weapons. But they would be obliterated. We would come out with ass-kicking, but we would come out. Russia would not come out. So he doesn't want a World War III. And Trump laid the groundwork. And he said, I'm getting in, and when I get in, I will ignore everything you do. You are welcome to Ukraine. Just give me that tower in Moscow. And that's what, so when it didn't work out, Putin had already resigned himself to get this done. He was going to get it done one way or the other. And the ball was already rolling when Trump was in office. Because if he would have been in office, they would have invaded January 9th of this year. But he had to wait now because he didn't know how Biden was going to take it. Let's just listen to Mayor Culper here.
Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa podcast. On Friday came news that California Representative Eric Swalwell, who led House impeachment efforts against Donald Trump, has become the latest plaintiff to sue the former president for his role in inciting the Capitol insurrection. The lawsuit aims to hold Trump, as well as his son Don Trump Jr., Rudy Giuliani, and Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama, accountable for inflaming tensions ahead of the January 6th riot.
We are now learning this morning that former President Trump is being sued by one of the impeachment managers, Eric Swalwell, filing the civil suit against not just the former president, but his son, Donald Trump Jr., Congressman Mo Brooks, Rudy Giuliani as well.
Swalwell's lawsuit follows one delivered by the NAACP on behalf of Representative Benny Thompson, which marvelously was served to Trump at his Mar-a-Lago residence last week. Just like Thompson's suit, Swalwell cites the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act, created to protect lawmakers from violence and intimidation. But Swalwell's suit, which was filed in the United States District Court in Washington, D.C. by the law firm Kaiser Dillon, goes further and accuses Trump and his key allies of breaking anti-terrorism laws, aiding and abetting violent rioters, and intentionally inflicting severe emotional distress on lawmakers who were at the Capitol that day.
The analogy would be a defendant in a criminal case being found not guilty by a jury and then being sued civilly for essentially the same conduct. It happens a lot. It happened with O.J. Simpson, for example. And that's essentially what we're looking at now. If the civil courts is the right forum, we're here and we're going to take this case and we're going to bring it before a judge and a jury and we're going to have the merits adjudicated that way.
The complaint alleges, as a direct and foreseeable consequence of the defendant's false and incendiary allegations of fraud and theft, and in direct response to the defendant's expressed calls for violence at the rally, a violent mob attacked the U.S. Capitol. Swalwell is also seeking unspecified financial damages from Trump's role in inciting the riot and is demanding Trump provide written notice 7 days in advance of a rally or public event hosted in Washington on an important election day.
It says that the siege was a direct and foreseeable consequence of the months of claims by Mr. Trump and the others in the lawsuit that the election was stolen. They all spoke at the rally, all those who were sued before the riot, and the lawsuit says they whipped up the crowd for violence, like a similar lawsuit filed last month by Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi and the NAACP. This one also invokes a federal civil rights law that allows lawsuits against government officials for claims that they conspired to violate civil rights.
Swalwell's lawsuit paints a much fuller picture of Trump's actions before and after the event. Drawing on House impeachment manager's case against the former president, suing under a wider theory of negligence. The suit does not focus on extremists who planned for violence, but the many more who were there for a political rally before the defendants and others alleged whipped them into a frenzy and turned them into violent mob that participated in the attack. Once again, Trump, who has long used the courts as a cudgel against his enemies, is getting it back in spades with this lawsuit, treating him like a nuisance that he is, and also seeking punitive damage that could create disastrous financial problems for the former president. The strategy here with these civil suits is death by a thousand cuts. If Trump couldn't be impeached wholesale and prevented from holding office, these lawsuits will make him a full-time defendant. eating away at his personal liberty and his pocketbook until the criminal trials can begin. The lawsuit concludes, the defendants, in short, convinced the mob that something was occurring that, if actually true, might indeed justify violence, and then sent the mob to the Capitol with violence-laced calls for immediate action. Ironically, it was left to Trump's lowlife spokesman and hooker enthusiast Jason Miller, who has his own well-recorded history with the courts, to provide response to Swalwell's suit, telling the Washington Post, Eric Swalwell is a lowlife with no credibility.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
The federal investigation into the January 6th riot is moving it slowly but methodically, with new information revealed daily about the origins of the insurrection or the people responsible for its derivation. Now comes news that the FBI has arrested the first actual Trump administration political appointee, 42-year-old Federico Klein, for his role in the storming of the Capitol. An FBI lookout bulletin issued 2 weeks after the Capitol assault included a picture of Klein, prompting an anonymous tipster to contact the FBI and finger him as the man in the photograph, according to an affidavit filed in federal court in Washington.
According to the FBI affidavit, as of January 6th, the day that this all went down, insurrection, Klein also had an active top secret security clearance. That same 16-page FBI affidavit published today by the New York Times reveals that Klein was present in some of the most grisly, violent, upsetting scenes at the Capitol on January 6th.
Video from police worn body cameras on January 6th shows Klein jamming a riot shield into doors at the Capitol as police were trying to secure them to keep the mob out. Klein was also heard on video trying to encourage others to fight with the police, yelling, "We need fresh people! We need fresh people!" Klein shouted repeatedly while seemingly acting out some latent Rambo fantasy he was unable to exercise from his psyche during paintball or Call of Duty.
We need fresh patriots and abroad!
Seems to have been a mid-level Trump campaign associate. I certainly never knew him during my time on the campaign. He's just another brainwashed MAGA schmuck who ruined his own life in service to the big lie and fat-ass Donald Trump.
And body camera footage shows that Klein himself pushed his way to the front of the crowd. That is a Trump administration official in the mob pushing his way to the front of the crowd, physically and verbally engaging with officers attempting to stop the invasion.
Klein worked on the 2016 campaign and was then hired at the State Department. He is charged with several felonies, including assault on police officers, interfering with police during civil disorder, and obstruction of an official proceeding, as well as lesser offenses. While a relative nobody in the Trump apparatus, Klein's arrest nonetheless brings the insurrection into the administration. Where it stops now is the ultimate question. Klein will likely be pressured to rat on his associates, and the FBI will begin chasing this up the ladder. And here we go, folks.
The FBI is investigating whether foreign governments, groups, or individuals may have funded extremists who helped plan and execute the January 6th attack. FBI sources telling NBC News that the Bureau is examining payments of $500,000 in Bitcoin, apparently by a French national, to key figures and groups in the alt-right before the riot. It's kind of weird.
Let's now shed a tear for those lowly Senate clerks who were forced into extra duty by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. In some misguided attempt at irony or owning the libs, as these folks like to say, Johnson had the clerks read out loud all 628 pages of the coronavirus stimulus bill, 100,000 words in all. It was a lame stunt aimed at registering his objections to the bill while using the Senate's arcane rules to delay debate on the bill.
I don't want to sound like a leftist, but I'm going to resist. Okay, so the first way I'm going to resist is I'm going to go down and object to the waiving of the reading of the bill. I will make them read their 600 to 700 page bill.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer accused Johnson of going to ridiculous lengths to show his opposition to the package, saying it will accomplish little more than a few sore throats for the Senate clerks who work very hard day in, day out to help the Senate function. Johnson, who is a dead ringer for George Costanza's boss from Kruger Industrial Smoothing on Seinfeld, defended his actions as necessary. But this guy is a total fucking asshole. The clerks finished at 2:04 a.m. after an 11-hour delay, allowing the bill to proceed into debate as required and accomplishing abso-fucking-lutely nothing.
Well, for real people, this is every minute, every hour. It means people are going hungry. It means they're getting further behind on their rent. They're worried about losing their car. This has already taken far, far too long. And I think in addition to the very, very human consequences, including for seniors, for children, there's also the fact that these kinds of procedural maneuvers really do shake the American people's confidence in government, which has already been badly shaken by the fact that the Senate, from March until the end of December, really took no action at all to deliver help with this pandemic to the American people.
This is where we have sunk with the GOP. Their ability to weaponize the arcane rules of the Senate to wreak fucking havoc on the political process is well known during the post-election certification crisis. But this nonsense is next level obnoxious. They have become a party of trolls and nothing more.
But on the real though, this is not just petty, it's disgusting. And on top of that, I'd respect him maybe a little bit more if he read the bill himself. But instead, this bitch is making some poor clerk read it. Like, you don't get to act like you're some heroic resistor if someone else is doing the work.
Now let's talk about Andrew Cuomo. We are equal opportunity here at Mea Culpa in our search for the truth and our desire to expose the hypocrisy and criminality of the political system wherever it leads. While the majority of the show is spent on Donald Trump and his inner circle, we still live by the credo of nothing but the truth. Besides, Cuomo is a fascinating and flawed human being who is entertaining to watch in his operatic desperation to be admired and adored.
Growing fallout for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and his administration over withholding COVID death toll numbers in nursing homes. The growing scrutiny comes just weeks after New York Attorney General Letitia James released a report claiming the state had undercounted nursing home deaths by as much as 50%. State health officials acknowledged the death toll was more than 15,000, much higher than originally reported.
A top Cuomo aide admitted withholding data for months over concerns the Trump Justice Department might use the info against them.
Those comments sparked immediate backlash among lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
State Republicans going so far as to say he should be impeached.
He possesses many of the same sociopathic traits as the Donald, and the Cuomos themselves go all the way back to Queens with the Trumps. Their mothers were friendly with one another. But this isn't a story about the Cuomos and the Trumps. We're here to talk about Andrew Cuomo and his own sociopathy.
I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart.
Last spring, as New York City suffered through the worst of COVID and the city became a morgue, Cuomo's daily pressers became a form of collective therapy for the city and appointment viewing for the rest of the country. That they were often opposite Trump's own COVID task force pressers drove the former president fucking insane. And Cuomo, no shrinking violet in the bully department, was able to shove it back in Trump's face to the glee of traumatized television watchers everywhere.
What are you going to grant me what the Constitution gave me before you were born? It's called the 10th Amendment. I didn't need the President of the United States to tell me that I'm governor. And I didn't need the President of the United States to tell me the powers of a state.
Twitter lit up with love letters to Cuomo, and the media wondered aloud why he was not running against Trump instead of Joe Biden. Here was the Donald's rhetorical equal, a man unafraid to punch back. But Cuomo never seriously considered running, nor did the DNC do much to encourage this line of thinking either. Why not? Because they knew, as did a lot of folks, that Cuomo was good at playing wartime consigliere.
What do you think, this is the army where you shoot them a mile away? You gotta get them close like this, bada-bing, you blow their brains all over your nice Ivy League suit.
But in his closet lurked a truckload of skeletons. There was just something a little off about him. Now, I'm not talking about the nipple rings or incessant self-regard and long-winded monologues. But there was this constant whisper that the guy was just sort of wrong.
I never touched anyone inappropriately. I never touched anyone inappropriately. I now understand that I acted in a way that made people feel uncomfortable.
Fine for New York State, but under the microscope of a national campaign, things would emerge. And emerge they have. First was the nursing home scandal and the reported purposeful undercounting of deaths. Cuomo attempted to brush it off by saying he did it to prevent Trump from weaponizing those statistics during the campaign. Then there was this creepy behavior towards women, harassment, and unwanted advances.
This morning, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo facing new calls for resignation after a third woman has come forward with accusations of sexual harassment. Anna Rook telling the New York Times the governor tried to kiss her at a New York City wedding reception in 2019 and then sharing this photograph she says was captured on her cell phone that night by a friend. Rook saying that when Governor Cuomo put his hand on her bare lower back, she, quote, promptly removed his hand with my hand. According to the paper, the governor remarked that she seemed aggressive and placed his hands on her cheeks. He asked if he could kiss her.
Finally, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that those COVID deaths were undercounted and delayed earlier than previously thought. Aides have admitted now to rewriting reports from the New York Health Department as early as last June. Cuomo, it seems, was eager to tout the state's success in handling the pandemic and was in the midst of writing a book on the subject entitled American Crisis that positioned him as the hero of COVID, uniquely qualified to lead the state through its darkest hour.
This morning, growing political fallout for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
We needed honesty and clarity, not confusion and evasiveness.
And many of us on both sides of this aisle have deep concerns.
State lawmakers voted Friday to revoke the emergency powers he was granted last year to handle the COVID crisis. This comes amid new reports from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal claiming his top aides altered a nursing home report to undercount and obscure the true death toll numbers.
Reading it now, in light of all of what has happened, has been a cringeworthy exercise in schadenfreude. But now independent investigators are leaning into the episode, and New York Attorney General Tish James has gotten involved. The knives are out for Cuomo. How this all shakes out is anybody's guess, but we'll keep watching.
Did you don't miss her? Yeah, what up, Tessa? Yeah.
And now for the main event. Last week's security threat at the Capitol put our current domestic terror threat into stark and urgent terms. While we may snicker and laugh at the intent of these groups as they plot to reinstall Donald Trump as president, they themselves are deadly serious. We are at a moment in time, not unlike the post-9/11 period, where we must figure out how to respond to the threat. My persistent fear is that January 6th was just the beginning, and that we are looking at a future where extremist violence and domestic terror becomes the number one threat to this nation. In order to better understand the preconditions to how we got to this place and better understand where we are headed, I reached out to Spencer Ackerman, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. His reporting on the January 6th insurrection and its aftermath has been appointment reading for me during this extraordinary moment. Prior to the Daily Beast, Ackerman was part of a team of reporters and editors at the Guardian newspaper who received the Pulitzer for their work on Edward Snowden and his whistleblowing activities related to the NSA. In addition, Ackerman wrote the upcoming book, Reign of Terror, for Penguin Random House, which will be in stores this August, and charts the profound impact that the war on terror had in pushing American politics and society in an authoritarian direction. Now that we are headed into a war on domestic terror, Ackerman's book is more relevant than ever, and I'm lucky to have his perspective on mea culpa. One of the thesis points for your book, Reign of Terror, is pinned atop your Twitter feed, and you write, explanations for how the U.S. reached its nationalist moment have overlooked something, the war on terror. Its generation-long brutality has left a toxic political legacy. Can you explain, please, to my listeners in what way this toxic political legacy led to the election of Donald Trump in the first place?
Sure thing, Michael, and thank you so much for inviting me on your podcast. This was not something I expected. I've been looking forward to it all week. And to get right into that, this is a conversation I'm very interested in getting your reactions to, not just as someone who is, you know, for so long in the Trump orbit, but just as, you know, if I'm not misunderstanding, we are two native New Yorkers, correct?
That is correct. You were from where?
I am from Flatbush, Brooklyn.
Oh, sure.
Where I still live.
Oh, interesting. My mom went to Midwood. And I was actually born in the Brooklyn Hospital on DeKalb Avenue. Know the area quite well.
Certainly well enough, unlike a lot of people, to pronounce it correctly with the correct inflection. Anyway, you asked about Reign of Terror. So, as a native New Yorker, you will, of course, remember the trauma, the horror and the outrage that resulted from 9/11. And what I think has become much clearer in retrospect is how powerful political figures at the beginning in the Republican Party, but always with the acquiescence out of fear of the Democratic Party, channeled that very real, very robust and very raw trauma into what I think we can fairly call a psychotic period in American foreign policy. A period where, on the one hand, the mechanisms of national security are spun up with new purpose and new direction, but not with new focus. And on a different level, a very raw feeling of besiegement and of anger was able to be channeled very easily into a culture war. And that culture war initially targeted Muslims. It initially treated immigrants not as a source of, you know, more Americans, but as a source of national danger. And these two strands of the policy level and the cultural level feed on each other in such a way after the wars deteriorate into things that the United States can't win, in such a way that they start looking for other targets. They start looking for targets closer to home, and they start coming up with explanations for why the U.S. can't, as such a supremely powerful nation, can't get out of this circumstance, that start leaning into kind of civilizational explanations, that this ultimately is a war against Islam, that it has nothing to do with the dominant position of American foreign policy and how such dominance throughout history, whoever does it, always breeds resistance. Some of that resistance will take the form of religiously inspired resistance. And particularly over the Obama years, which is kind of the meat of my book, Reign of Terror, you start seeing this, what I like to call a decadent phase of the war on terror, after it seems the wars can't be won themselves. Obama decides after the Osama bin Laden raid not to declare this era over and start unwinding some of the emergency powers, if not all of the emergency powers that were passed after 9/11, into this sense that results as there's always another explanation for who is stopping the United States from winning. that it becomes this person in the White House who, you know, mysteriously, by being the first African-American president, attracts a lot of racist conspiracy theories. It's important that we recognize that one of those conspiracy theories, the principal one, in fact, birtherism, the one that your former boss spread, if not, you know, acting as the supreme practitioner of it, is itself a creation of the war on terror, because it's not just that he's black, it's not just that he is, which he was not, allegedly foreign and Kenyan, but that he was Muslim. And the problem, supposedly, the thing that's sort of lurking in the subtext, if not particularly subtly, of birtherism, is that there is an enemy of the United States at a time of war in the White House, and he is why the United States can't seem to win the war on terror. And then the longer that this happens, as long as these two dynamics, the policy dynamic, the political dynamic, the cultural dynamic, feed on one another, it becomes, I believe, and I will, you know, endeavor to show in this book, inevitable that whether it was Trump, whether it would have been someone else, someone would have been able to walk through this very open door, this door that's open to nativism now, that also allows, as we saw during the Trump administration, but also during earlier administrations, demagogues who want to use the mechanisms, the architecture, the weapons of the war on terror in places like Portland, where you saw the Department of Homeland Security stuffing people into vans, things that immigrants, since DHS had been around, had been rather used to. And you start seeing the way these dynamics feed upon themselves in really disturbing ways. By the way, that's not to say the right has no critique of the war on terror that isn't worth listening to. There have been anti-war voices on the right that have spoken up about it quite frequently. The thing that I also try and explore in the book is how much of those sort of fed the other nationalist and nativist purposes, the anti-immigrant crusade and the anti-Muslim crusade. So that's sort of the way, in a nutshell, even though that might not have been a nutshell, the book kind of takes its critique. And I'm very curious what you saw up close and personal as all of this happened in the Trump circle.
Well, I can really speak because I was there at the time of the birtherism between Trump and his hatred for Barack Obama. His hatred for Barack Obama was predicated upon two things. First and foremost, actually, let's make it three. First and foremost is the fact that he's black. The second is the fact that he's brilliant. And that's something that Donald Trump has a problem with because he realizes his own inadequacies. And then the third, which really drove Trump crazy, was the fact that Barack Obama was wildly popular, especially outside of the United States. I'll never forget sitting in Trump's office when we spoke about Barack Obama in Germany, and there must have been about a million people lining up that gigantic mall and applauding for him and truly excited to see the first black American president. And that really pissed Trump off. Something that I, to this day, I can't exactly explain why, other than the fact that it's just his own lack of self, and that Trump needs to be adored and jeered by people in order to give him his own self-worth, something that really he's just missing, and he's missing terribly. But I wanted also to bring up to you, Spencer, that just this morning, Capitol Police had...
Now, that was the wrong piece, and I don't know how it got crossed up over here, but that was the wrong piece, which was a very good piece because it talked about some of the things that I was saying when I first started here this morning, this afternoon. Why we're in this war. Barack Obama could not get us in this war because he would be a black man that got the United States into war. So he did everything in his power, everything just to move and dodge and twist and turn, try to keep the war from coming on as long as he could. He could not have started that war because we would never get another person of color in the White House again. because that would be the first thing they said. You put a black man in there, he didn't know what the hell he's doing, and he got us into a world war. World War III with nuclear weapons going on, going off. So Barack Obama could not have stopped them when they went into Ukraine. He couldn't have done anything about that because he would have taken the major stab and knockdown. So, I want to play the mea culpa, which is the one that you need to hear, which I'm going to do right now.
Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa Podcast. One step forward, two steps back. That's the cadence of the January 6th committee's investigation. For every big win, for every fucking smoking gun and tantalizing possibility that the truth is at hand, there is the political reality that all of this may very well vanish next year. Regardless, there have been victories. And last Thursday's arrest of Oath Keeper founder Stuart Rhodes is quite possibly the biggest win yet.
This is CNN breaking news.
And we begin with the breaking news. The leader of the extremist Oath Keepers appearing in court to face the most serious charges yet in the insurrection investigation.
Federal prosecutors now indicting militia leaders for trying to overthrow the U.S. government. These are new charges against 10 rioters and militia leaders for their direct roles in the January 6th insurrection. Now, this is huge news in the probe because, one, it's the first sedition charge. Two, it's a key charge going up the line to the plotters of this insurrection for the first time. And three, it shows an open probe escalating, not winding down, which is possibly bad news for other insurrectionists and coup plotters yet to be potentially charged.
Rhodes, the leader and founder of the far-right Oath Keepers militia, was arrested on Thursday and charged along with 10 others with seditious conspiracy over what prosecutors said was their wide-ranging plot to storm the Capitol on January 6th last year and disrupt the certification of Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s electoral victory.
Well, the feds say in this brand new serious indictment that Oath Keepers militia founder Stuart Rhodes led a literal criminal seditious conspiracy.
He needs to know from you that you are with him, that he does not do it now while he is commander-in-chief. We're going to have to do it ourselves later in a much more desperate, much more bloody war. Let's get it on now while he is still the commander-in-chief.
This is a major development for those seeking accountability and justice for the January 6th plotters, with Rhodes and other Oath Keepers being the first to be charged with sedition among the more than 700 people accused so far of taking part in the assault.
They allege and indict him for, quote, trying to oppose the lawful transfer of presidential power by force through the violent January 6th attack, and state that that attack was an illegal hindering of the laws governing the transfer of power. In the language of federal law, violently opposing that transfer of power to President-elect Biden is sedition.
The Justice Department has brought a variety of charges in connection with the Capitol attack. It has prosecuted about 275 people for obstructing Congress's duty to certify the 2020 presidential vote count, for example. But it had not previously brought a sedition charge with the legal weight and political overtones it carries about an election in a highly polarized country.
This is really a landmark charge by the Justice Department. We've seen up to this point 700 plus charges. This is the first time we've seen the Justice Department charge sedition or seditious conspiracy. I think these charges, based on the complaints and the indictments that I've seen, are well-founded here. If anything, they're overdue. And focusing again on the conspiracy piece, we now know that according to the Justice Department, a domestic extremist group, an organized domestic extremist group, was behind a significant part of this attack on the Capitol. That's an incredibly important statement by the Justice Department.
The charge of seditious conspiracy, which can be difficult to prove, requires prosecutors to show that at least two people agreed to use force to overthrow government authority or delay the execution of a U.S. law. Rhodes faces 20 years in prison for the charge.
That's why sedition against the U.S. is so serious and so rarely charged. Many murders, another very serious felony, are charged every year. But we checked, and best we can tell, the United States has not charged someone with sedition for over a decade. It was against a Michigan militia member last time in 2010.
Prosecutors said that beginning only days after the 2020 election, Stuart Rhodes oversaw a seditious plot to oppose the lawful transfer of presidential power by force. Some members of the Oath Keepers, under his command, broke into the Capitol in a military-style assault on January 6th and went in search of Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the indictment said. Others, it said, were stationed in a hotel in Alexandria, Virginia, as an armed quick reaction force ready to rush into Washington if needed.
Department, correct me if I'm wrong saying this. Some of the Oath Keepers have already begun cooperating with some of the investigators.
Exactly right, Allison. Let this put to rest the myth-making and the revisionist history and the outright denialism around January 6th. I mean, it's laid out there in black and white by the Justice Department, with, by the way, quite strong proof to back it up laid out in the indictment, including quoted electronic communications. This indictment, when you read it, it is clear this was an organized effort. This was an effort that was organized not on the spot, but for days and weeks in advance. There were elements of weaponry, of armaments, of tactical movements. And again, the group that was putting this all together, or one of the groups that was putting this all together, was the Oath Keepers. We know who they are. That is a domestic extremist group. These are facts. The Justice Department lays them out very clearly in the indictment, and that's why this is such a high-impact charge.
The new indictment paints a terrifying portrait of Rhodes' activities starting only days after the 2020 election. Just 2 days after November 3rd, Rhodes told several members of his group to refuse to accept a Biden victory. "We aren't getting through this without a civil war," he wrote on an encrypted chat app Signal. Too late for that. Prepare your mind, body, and spirit.
He also, according to this new evidence, was studying a Serbian coup plot where citizens did overrun a parliament building. They ousted the president. So that's some of the footage you're seeing of what inspired, allegedly, these people on January 6th. Reading again from this indictment, citing the evidence, quote, "We must now do what the people of Serbia did when Milosevic stole their election, refused to accept it, march in mass to the nation's capital." Rhodes published the plan of action under the headline, "What We the People Must Do." This was on the Oath Keepers website.
1 month later, after plotting with subordinates in several states, Rhodes told members of his group on the Signal app that they should use overwhelming force and violence to stop Biden from taking office. "It will be a bloody and desperate fight," he wrote. "We are going to have a fight. That can't be avoided."
And also, if you look at what they had, I mean, these are just some of the weaponry and tactics that were discussed on these group chats. They brought shotguns and scopes, magazines, sights, optics, AR platforms, rifles, firearms, night vision devices, a boat that could handle a Potomac crossing. They said, "We could have our team with the heavy weapons standing by, quickly load them and ferry them across the river." This was not a casual conspiracy. This was, it sounds like, an active military plan. Revealed in the court documents were just chilling. 2 days after the election, Rhodes allegedly writing to his followers, "We aren't getting through this without a civil war." And the prosecutors say that images like these show the Oath Keepers unloading weapons in a Virginia hotel just ahead of January 6th.
There's also the reality that, had things gone differently, we would have witnessed a horrific slaughter. According to the indictment, the Oath Keepers attempted to make a coordinated move on the Senate chamber and tried to push their way through a line of police officers who forcibly repelled their advance and seemingly stopped them from executing their mission.
The Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and the 3% militias had multiple meetings about this. They started and really started getting people ready in late October, early November, sending them to training schools, having them, you know, have 1,500, you know, 150 rounds of combat load ammunition on their weapons, getting their body armor together. What you saw on January 6th was the command cell of the Oath Keepers. There were many, many, many hundreds more Oath Keepers there. It's a big organization. It's just that this was Stuart Rhodes' teams that he was bringing into the building. And if you recall that very night, we were on this very program, I said it's quite possible that these people may have had capture and kill teams that were organized to go in there. Murder cells is another way that we put them, and that they would be very well organized. This entire sedition was, you know, the insurrection in itself was well organized, because not only did they plan it, they also sent orders out to everyone, and thousands of people came dressed like them.
Other rioters managed to get inside the Senate floor and gallery, but the Oath Keepers, who prosecutors say had stockpiled firearms at a nearby hotel in Virginia for a quick reaction force, were prevented by police from breaking through, and the new indictment dramatically raises the stakes of the plot to prevent Joe Biden from becoming president.
Selecting this charge is really DOJ framing the issues around January 6th. And Joy, as you noted, this indictment is careful to set forth that they're looking not just at that day itself, but at what preceded it and what followed it. So they're looking at a conspiracy and ongoing course of conduct. And unlike prior indictments, this is not an indictment that alleges obstruction of Congress. This is not an indictment that talks about being on the Capitol grounds without permission. This sets forth a seditious conspiracy, an effort to interfere with the transfer of power, and it brings new gravitas to the way that DOJ is viewing these events, confirming that they're going after the heart of a conspiracy to take down democracy.
According to the indictment, Rhodes became more serious about stopping Mr. Biden from assuming office in early January, the same month he began spending $17,000 on military-grade firearms, ammunition, and other tactical gear. He seemed to relish the chaos on the Capitol on January 6th, prosecutors said. The indictment noted that shortly after 3 p.m. that day, a member of his Signal group chat sent him a message saying that members of Congress had been given gas masks and are trying to get out, Rhodes allegedly said. Fuck them! Now it's Rhodes and his arrogant cohort of far-right extremists who are the ones about to get fucked. They successfully evaded prosecution for years by wrapping themselves in the flag. Not anymore, fellas. Sedition means you are traitors and will be branded as such for the rest of your lives.
It's important to note here, inside this indictment, there is no, as far as I can tell, direct link to the Trump White House or the Trump political world. They haven't written that down yet. But does that mean at this point that investigators aren't looking for that link?
Oh, heck no, they'll be looking for that. Look, you have one simple, not simple, but one straight line case here. That is, did people gather together with the idea that this might be a Civil War 2.0? Yes. That's a totally different question from the politically explosive question of was there any communication before or after with, for example, a congressional office. I don't see why you'd have to put that in the indictment, but that's why people like the January 6th committee want to talk to members of Congress. Did you talk to these people, and we'd like to see your phone records? That's why they're going with subpoenas to the Silicon Valley, saying we want data. This is not done yet, John.
While the arrest of Rhodes for seditious conspiracy will strike a blow against the entire far-right militia movement, it still stops short of arresting and charging those people who actually organized the insurrection. If the Oath Keepers were the paramilitary force, we still need to hear from those who they communicated with. It may not have been Donald Trump, but we know they were protecting Roger Stone. Who else did they coordinate with leading up to January 6th? Unfortunately, this is the frustrating part of the investigation. We only get so far up the ladder. Now comes word that Kevin fucking McCarthy is refusing to testify before the January 6th committee, slamming shut the possibility that we'll ever know what Trump said to the minority leader as the Capitol was being ransacked. By doing so, he has raised the prospect of a subpoena of the highest-ranking House Republican, prompting legal questions with little court precedent and escalating the political stakes of the investigation.
Top House Republican Kevin McCarthy defiant tonight in the face of a request for testimony from the January 6th committee.
There is nothing that I can provide the January 6th committee for legislation of their moving forward. There is nothing in that realm. It is pure politics of what they're playing.
Representative Scott Perry and asshole Jim fucking Jordan, who spoke with Trump leading up to and during and after the insurrection, have also balked at the committee's request for voluntary interviews. Last Wednesday, McCarthy issued a blistering statement condemning the committee as illegitimate and saying that he would refuse to cooperate with its inquiry. On Thursday, he argued that the panel was violating the privacy of Republicans through subpoenas for bank and phone records. McCarthy also again denounced Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, for having rejected two of his five choices to sit on the panel, one of whom was motherfucking Jim Jordan. Never did I think a speaker would play such politics, he declared.
McCarthy's refusal now to detail his conversations with Donald Trump during and after the attack, a departure from his position last summer.
Would you be willing to testify about your conversation with Donald Trump on January 6th if you were asked by an outside commission?
Sure.
You
Next
would.
Question. The Republican leader now joining two other House Republicans in refusing to cooperate. Is it problematic for the investigation if all House Republicans just have refused to talk to them?
Yeah, we will seek the truth. We will find the truth.
Now the committee, who say they have conducted nearly 400 interviews, must decide what steps they're willing to take to secure those of their colleagues.
It seems that McCarthy is relishing the opportunity to play martyr. The possibility that he is charged, like Steve Bannon, with felony criminal contempt is unprecedented in modern American politics and raises all manner of legal questions as well as a myriad of challenges facing the committee to get these schmucks to tell the fucking truth.
Look, I think the reality is McCarthy is a very weak leader, and as a result, he is already being led around by the most extreme elements of his conference, the Marjorie Taylor Greens and others, that are calling for retribution because of their removal. The departure from precedent here was McCarthy's failure to hold his own members accountable, which traditionally Democratic leaders and Republican leaders have policed their own. But McCarthy's been too weak to do that, and so it required Democrats to take action when Paul Gosar was glorifying the killing of one of his colleagues, and similarly when Marjorie Taylor Greene was espousing her conspiratorial QAnon and anti-Semitic stuff. I think the precedent that's been broken here has been broken by McCarthy. It doesn't surprise me, though, that he is being led already by these extreme elements, and it's one of the reasons why he can never be allowed to become Speaker. More importantly, though, if I can say, Aaron, then whatever he might do vis-a-vis Democrats and committee assignments is the fact that he will do whatever Donald Trump wants him to do, and if Donald Trump wants him to overturn the next election because Trump loses again, McCarthy will do it.
In a letter on Wednesday, Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the committee, said the panel wanted to ask Mr. McCarthy a range of questions about both his efforts to get Mr. Trump to issue a statement calling off the mob during the attack and his conversations with the president in the days after the attack, apparently including efforts to get him to stop challenging Mr. Biden's presidential victory.
Look, Kevin's a coward. He's a moral coward. If he goes to that committee, he's going to have two options. Number one, either he has to perjure himself to protect Donald Trump or tell the truth about what happened and piss off Donald Trump and therefore lose Donald Trump's support. He can't be Speaker. At the end of the day, Kevin's going to do whatever he can. He'll sell whoever he can, do whatever he can. He's a craven politician to become Speaker of the House, and that's what you're seeing.
In his statement later that day, Mr. McCarthy accused the committee of an abuse of power, complaining that it wants to interview me about public statements that have been shared with the world and private conversations not remotely related to the violence that unfolded at the Capitol.
Did you tell House Republicans on the January 11th phone call that President Trump told you he agreed that he bore some responsibility for January 6th, as Chairman Thompson's letter indicates?
I'm not sure what call you're talking about.
I say he has responsibility. He told me personally that he does have some responsibility.
Mr. Thompson has said publicly several times that nobody is off limits and that the panel would consider issuing subpoenas for members of Congress who do not voluntarily cooperate with the investigation. In a January 2nd interview on NBC's Meet the Press, he said, "I think there are some questions of whether we have the authority to do it. We're looking at it. If the authorities are there, there'll be no reluctance on our part."
That doesn't mean the president is free from fault. The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility. Quell the brewing unrest. And ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term. And the president's immediate action also deserves congressional action, which is why I think a fact-finding commission and a censure resolution would be prudent. Unfortunately, that is not where we are today. Truly, this past week was one of the most difficult for Congress and our nation. Of all the days here, last Wednesday was the worst day I've ever seen in Congress. Our country is deeply hurt.
Let's get real, though. McCarthy is covering up for Trump in the worst possible way. In refusing to testify to the House Select Committee, McCarthy is allowing Trump to get away with a litany of crimes. That's because McCarthy, who reportedly appealed to Trump as the violence unfolded, likely has some of the most direct knowledge available of Trump's conduct as the mob rampaged continued. That could have criminal implications if Trump's attempt to subvert the electoral count in Congress amounted to an effort to obstruct an official proceeding.
His own statements came into the Senate impeachment trial through Republican Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler, who McCarthy told he had called Donald Trump on January 6th, essentially to say, "Help us, save us from this." And Trump said, "Oh, it's not my people, it's not MAGA, it's Antifa." And at that point, McCarthy said, "No, it's not Antifa, it's your people, and you got to save us." And then Trump, of course, famously said, "Well, maybe they just care a little bit more about a fair election than you do, Kevin." But he's got to cover up the fact that he did the right thing in reacting like a human being, saying, "Call these dogs off." And now he's got to cover it up because they're so sycophantic and submissive to this pathological leader, Donald Trump.
The true nature of what that conversation was continues to evade the public record. It's not just that it could reveal that Trump displayed a callous disregard for human life, as well as extraordinary depravity and malevolence in ignoring numerous frantic pleas to call off the rioters. It's also that this knowledge could reveal that Trump may have come to see the violence as instrumentally helpful to his cause of subverting the election's outcome. Did he or did he not send the Oath Keepers on a mission to subvert the election? Was the violence that day deliberate? And if so, who gave the ultimate orders? These are questions we may never get answered.
The far-right wing militia group, the Oath Keepers, will remain in jail at least for now. Stuart Rhodes is charged with seditious conspiracy. Investigators believe he was trying to overthrow the government. Kevin Reese spoke to legal experts about what the charge means and whether it will stick.
Remember this video, the men in military-style stack formation working their way through the insurrection crowd to get into the Capitol. They are among the 19 Oath Keeper members charged in the Capitol riot, and the FBI says Elmer Stewart Rhodes III from Granbury, Texas, gave the orders to attack, including texting his followers, "We aren't getting through this without a civil war." Seditious conspiracy is among the charges he faces, as do 11 of the 19 Oathkeeper defendants, and on that charge alone face a maximum penalty of 20 years in federal prison if convicted.
Generally, these cases trip up on the issue of free speech. There's a very high standard set for conviction in such cases.
Which is what his supporters wanted to talk about after the hearing, that they believe he had the right to talk about opposing the election results.
And the way to fix that is to storm the Capitol.
Nobody said to storm the Capitol. See, that's the funny part. That's the twist. That's the lie. And what is happening in D.C. is unethical.
In court Friday, a federal judge ordered Rhodes held at least until a detention hearing next Thursday. His attorneys will argue that he should be released pending trial.
Is he a danger and is he a flight risk? We don't think the government can prove either one.
He's got no criminal history. He's a Yale Law graduate. He has no passport, so he's not a flight risk.
But the FBI also accuses him of backing up the alleged threats with the purchase of $40,000 worth of ammunition and equipment.
You have to actually have those words connected to action.
The kind of evidence that experts say could be enough to keep him locked up until a trial.
Washington is still buzzing over the bombshell announcement on CBS's Face the Nation that the Trump administration had a plan that would have authorized the Department of Defense to seize voting machines in several battleground states. CBS's Scott McFarland has that and today's news from Capitol Hill.
In the courthouse in Plano, Texas, prosecutors accused Oathkeepers founder Stuart Rhodes of using force to stop the peaceful transfer of power and said he must remain in jail pending trial. Lawyers revealed that Rhodes, the alleged coordinator of the Oathkeepers' assault on the Capitol, is also cooperating with the January 6th committee, making him the latest key figure to do so. CBS News has confirmed the committee is investigating a draft executive order circulated by some in the Trump administration that would have ordered the Pentagon to seize voting machines from several battleground states where they alleged fraud took place.
We are concerned that our military was part of this big lie on promoting that the election was false.
The order, which was never signed by former President Trump, would have also involved the Department of Justice. Thompson revealed Sunday that former Attorney General Bill Barr has had a voluntary conversation with the committee.
So if you are using the military to potentially seize voting machines, even though it's a discussion, the public needs to know. We've never had that before.
Also tonight, a Georgia court has granted local prosecutors' request for a special grand jury to investigate whether the former president tried to interfere with Georgia's 2020 election results. Mr. Trump has referred to that as a political witch hunt. Nora?
Scott McFarland, thank you.
Okay. A political witch hunt. That's what he says. Well, now, I played the mea culpa because I wanted to talk about why this war started. And as I've been saying all along, it started when Trump was in office. This was his deal with Putin. He wanted to build a tower in Moscow, and his first thing that he wanted to do, he said, I will get rid of the Iran nuclear weapons treaty. I will get rid of NATO. I will make it so miserable for those countries in Europe that they will be disgusted and they will drop out. And then you can go in and take over, which is what he wanted, Ukraine. He went in a little bit, as I said before, and got the little country that's off of what was part of Ukraine. He took a little piece of it before, but now he wanted to rest. And his thing with Trump was he wants to get back the Soviet Union. He believes it's the worst disaster that's happened in the 21st century, and he has said this. So Trump got in. He got rid of the treaty with Iran, and he made it so miserable for these people in NATO, making them pay payments that he knew they couldn't pay, and that he made so miserable for all the relative presidents and prime ministers that they were sick of the United States. and they were arguing with one another. So this was his deal. And he said, don't worry, U.S. will not do anything. You go take Ukraine. NATO won't do anything unless we say so. And there won't be a NATO. Won't be a NATO. And we will let you run amok if you want. You can take back Czechoslovakia. You can take back Poland. You can take back all those little countries, Moldova, that all went rapid away from the Soviet Union to form their own government. This is what Putin wanted. But the thing that they didn't figure was they didn't get elected. And they got caught. And it was too far down the road for Putin not to change his mind about the invasion. Now we know what they don't have. They lost about 3 generals. They got less generals now. They're using dumb bombs that you just lob at someplace because they don't care about killing the people or the infrastructure. They want no infrastructure around them. They'd rather have completely bombed out countries so there's nobody there that can invade them. Nobody can stop them. That's not going to happen because he's going to go over the line a little bit here in Ukraine and UN is going to step in. Mark my word. Anyway, we're back to civilization now in North Carolina. Oh, and before I forget, I just saw a piece on television that our great leader, used to be our leader here, Mark Meadows, is probably going to be charged with false documentation on his 2020 election election registration that he sent in because he's out. He put in that he was living in some place. I forgot the name of the place. He was living in there in a trailer home. That's what he said. He put down he was living in the trailer home and he filled out the form, but he never lived there. And they found out that that place had nothing inside of it. It was completely empty. So when he did the 2020 election, he did absentee ballot, and he put this place down as his registration. He never lived there. That's fraud, isn't it? Well, we'll ask our next guest, who's going to be the first representative from the newly formed 112th District in North Carolina. Now, this is the newly formed. Now, see, here's what I don't understand. Why these clowns, and they are clowns, the Republicans that run the legislature in North Carolina, why they added another district in North Carolina? Because they didn't get anything out of it. They added another Democratic district. It's now going to be called the new 112th district here in Mecklenburg County. And it's all Democrat. So they gave the Democrats one more Democratic district. We'll ask the gentleman that's running for it, Mr. Jay Holman, about that. Welcome, Solomon.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. As always, it's a pleasure to be with you. My name is Jay Holman. I am a candidate for North Carolina House, District 112. It has been an interesting development, to say the least. When we watched the first set of maps that came out and the way they were gerrymandered so drastically to the left, and when the Supreme Court turned down all the rejections and all of the appeals and everything else, said we're going to do it this way, that's what we should have done in the very beginning, to be honest. Right. We took our look at the census reports and we said this is where our population is. These are the levels of representation that they need. And we created the 112. It's my honor to be in that district. It was so funny when I realized over the course of the last gerrymandering of the districts, I jumped from 99 to 100 and now to 112.
Cool. What's the reason why they gave us another Democratic district?
I think it was the court system, honestly, Mike, that sat down and said, it's time for us to let go of this, you know, partisanship, and let's just do what's right by the number of people that we have and the number of people that are represented. Yes, this is a great victory for the Democratic Party here in North Carolina to have a predominantly Democratic district created. Hopefully this will lead to us breaking the supermajority the Republicans hold in the House. And I look forward to representing my district well, to the best of my ability.
Have they ever, did they ever create any Republican districts?
There were two districts, there were two districts located in the northern part of the state that they split. Literally split, and they became two Republican districts. But at the end of the day, the numbers still favor the Democrats in the House.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we're down how many seats in the House?
Actually,
before this new map.
Right now, that's hard to say because this is an interesting election cycle, for one, and to say that we're down. With the new redrawing of everything, we might actually be up. So we're almost close to, you know, even or definitely breaking the supermajority.
Okay. So now tell us, why do you want to run for this office?
You know,
what's the purpose of it?
Here's the thing. Right?
What's your purpose, I should say?
I've sat back over the course of, you know, the last almost 20 years that I've been in North Carolina. And 20 plus years now that I look back on it. And I have watched the North Carolina General Assembly basically shift so far to the right that they can't go unchecked anymore. They can't go unchecked anymore. I believe in the voice of the people. And I have talked to my constituents throughout, you know, the Matthews, Mid Hill area, and their biggest concern is the fact that they don't feel like they're being heard. They don't feel like they're being heard in Charlotte. They don't feel like they're being heard in Raleigh. And it is time for us to bring a voice to Raleigh.
But if Charlotte is 90% Democrat, right?
Yes.
And some of the people don't feel like they're being heard.
Exactly.
Well, maybe they need to get rid of representatives that are representing them in Charlotte.
And that's why I'm running. It's time for a voice to go to Raleigh that's going to represent the entire constituency of this new 112.
Well, that's great. So what's some of the things that you want to do to give or represent these people of Charlotte, Mecklenburg County?
I think the foremost and most important thing is the question of housing. It's not a question of affordable housing as we hear it talked about, as much as it is the regulation of outside investors coming into the neighborhoods and outpricing housing. So you've got people that are coming in from out of state, and all they're doing is buying property and hoping to develop it later. But at the meantime, the people that actually live here are stuck with the rising cost of their taxes. Their taxes are going up.
I can tell you that. I mean, right behind me is woods, and it's about 2.5 acres. And my daughter, Janine, she wanted to buy this to build a house, and she was thinking about it, and it was like $59,000, did she tell you, right?
Right.
$59,000. And the next day, not next day, that week, that was a Sunday. That Monday, she didn't put in the bid for the buy it. It went up double.
Right. Right.
It was up to $118,000
right.
in 1 week. And then in the next week, it went up again half.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, unbelievable.
We have outside developers that are coming into our neighborhoods, coming into our state, and they're coming into our communities, and they're buying property.
Oh.
And they have deep pockets.
I get calls at least 5, 6, 7 times a day. Calls. I get emails 10 or 20 times a day. Oh, we passed by your house and we like it. And please give us a call. We will give you the best buy. I mean, they didn't try to warm you up. They want to buy your house right away, the first sentence.
Exactly. And it's sad because we that live here in North Carolina, we don't have $2.5 million sitting in our back pocket that we can go down and just buy a lot, okay? And the other turn to that is we don't have the additional 800 and some odd dollars a year that it's going to cost us in property tax because they came in and they bought that lot. You know, we need to be more concerned about our local residents' ability to own property than allowing, you know, outside development to come in and say, okay, you know, I want to do this for the city. No, you don't.
Well, it's unbelievable. Right where my church is, of Lady of Consolation, that was sort of a depressed area. And it was sort of a depressed area. And the last 5 years, they completely tore down everything. And now around me, around the church, you can't, that are apartment complexes, duplexes, condos that start, and houses that start at $350,000.
Right.
Start. They're $2,000 a month for the apartments that they built. None of those people that lived in that area are there now because they can't afford to buy it.
Exactly. Michael, and that goes back to the second leg. I'm looking at, you know, developing a way to maintain economic equality and sustainability across the board. We need to raise the minimum wage. We need to put it at least at $15 an hour. As it stands right now, with the developers coming in, being allowed by the lack of regulation in the state, and the lack of wage being comparable, right? We have firefighters, we have teachers, we have, you know, even people that work at McDonald's not being able to even dream the American dream of household ownership.
They can't live here because the property costs too much to live in. Where did all those people that lived around the church now go?
Exactly.
Where did they go?
Exactly.
Because they're not there anymore. They're not there anymore. That whole community is completely changed. Oh, beautiful. Beautiful buildings, beautiful houses, beautiful condos. They're beautiful. But where do those people go?
You know, they go home that they don't have. They literally go to a home that they don't have. It was interesting. Last night I was watching the mayoral forum, and it was indicated by Mayor Lowes that every new project and every new development is required to have a 10% affordable housing cap on it. But what's affordable at the end of the day?
Right. Hey.
If I'm making $7 an hour, right, I still can't afford $2,200 a month for housing.
Right. And the closer you get to the city, the higher the prices are.
Of
well,
course.
This is just like New York. Mm-hmm. You go to New York now, you have one bedroom apartment, $2,500 a month minimum.
Right.
If you're in 5 miles within 10 miles within downtown Manhattan.
Right.
Or Brooklyn. Or Queens. Because they have bridges linking them all. But you have places, you have travel connections in New York City. You have no travel connections here.
Yeah.
If you don't have a car, you ain't getting nowhere because the bus is not going to take you there. The bus is not going to take you there when you need to get there.
Right.
The bus is not going to take you there.
Yeah. And that's there comes the third leg. We have to take the federal money for the infrastructure package, and we have to utilize that to make Charlotte proper and the outlying areas more accessible. There is no reason, for instance, and this is going to sound wild, and I'm just going to put it out there. Why can't we put an L train down Providence Road? It's elevated.
Providence
Road.
No.
Think about it.
No. With all them high-priced houses? No. No way.
Going straight down Providence Road.
Oh,
and
yeah, right
now, the road belongs to the state. And it's
too
narrow just to get buses down there. That's one of our biggest problems. So why not put an L train
down
Providence Road? Send it all the way out to Wellington. Why not reach out to the people that need access to the city?
Yeah, but those people in Providence Road don't need access to the city. They don't got cars.
They don't. That's why there's an express train that goes straight through. But at the end of the day, at the end of the day, we seriously need to take a look at our infrastructure across the entire
county. But do you
county.
Seriously think the people of Brownsville want somebody out there will look up, there's the elderly going by? I don't think so.
Come on, we put up walls around our highways. It's like, if you didn't want to hear the noise, you wouldn't leave the highway.
That's true.
But at the end of the day,
let me ask you something about independence now.
Yeah.
I mean, if you get off on the wrong bridge, you can't make a turnaround in Independence now.
Not a bit.
I mean, what the? I had to travel at least 2 miles to make a turnaround to come back around the motor vehicle the other day.
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
And you know, those are the things that need to be changed. We need to honestly have somebody sitting there that's taking a look at our city layout, our planning, our design, our development, and say, you know, it's time for us to do something that's
works for
the day-to-day people.
But who's in charge of this development?
The sad part about it is most of this relies on the county and relies on the city. And from a state perspective, we can provide the funds. Send me a plan. Give me a proposal. Let me know how much money you need. Where do you want
to go?
Okay,
but who provided the funds before you got here? Who is providing? Because that Independence Boulevard is a complete disaster.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I went down this street before we could go down in, what's that street over here? There you go. Fairview.
Right.
Straight down Fairview. Go over to Independence, make a turn, and then go across Independence and come down the other side of Independence.
Right.
Now, you got to go down Fairview. You got to cross over the highway to get on the other side. But that's only going in one direction.
Right.
So you got to stay on the same side. You get off and get on the highway, but you got to go almost 2 miles, a mile and a half,
right,
to make the turnaround, because there is no other turnaround, to come back down the other side.
Exactly.
That's completely outrageous.
And, of course, this is why we're looking at the need for a comprehensive infrastructure package, right, that involves city, state, and local input. Everybody's got to be involved, because at the end of the day, if I don't know what you need, I don't know what to provide you with. But my thing is, let's talk. Let's sit down.
Well, somebody's giving these people the information up there now, giving the county and the state, like, yeah, you can do this.
But
who's doing that?
Our biggest problem, even with that, Michael, is the fact that we have a legislature right now that sits there and says, I don't want to take the federal money. Right, that's our biggest problem, is that the money is there, but they don't want it. They don't want to send it down the pipe. They don't want to spend it. They don't want to get.
And that's the Republican Party that's in charge.
And that's the Republican Party that's in charge. We have fiscal responsibility, right? We have a fiscal responsibility to be conservative and be manageable of how we spend our money, right? That's not to say don't spend the money, because every once in a while. Come April 15th, write that check.
Ain't that true? Ain't that true?
It almost reminds me of this joke. This one guy said he was talking about getting audited, and he said he walks into the IRS office and there's a sign on the door that says "Watch your step," and on his way out there's a sign that says "Watch your language." So the other side was this guy that was getting held up, and he was an IRS agent, and he looked at the robber and he said, "Don't hold me up. You know, I work for the IRS. Don't shoot me." And the guy looked at him and said, "Well, in that case, give me back my money." it's a fine line between, you know, sitting there and saying that we have a responsibility to provide, but we're not willing to provide. And so we find ourselves in a stagnated stalemate to where nothing gets accomplished. I think it's time to break that gridlock. I think it's time for us to make a change and be effective and do something that's going to be rewarding, literally rewarding for the citizens of 112.
Well, now, what's some of the other things that you want to get involved with, that you need to be involved with?
I think, you know, it's important for us to realize that, you know, we are a community. We are a community. And as such, as we look at the crime rates going up, there are issues on gun control, gun violence that are raging out of control. There are issues as far as joblessness, you know, employment rates. There's educational situations. I mean, our biggest challenge right now is getting our children back up to the educational level they were pre-COVID. That's our biggest challenge. And the only way to do that is to provide our teachers with a decent wage, provide them with the staff support that they need, and provide them with a safe working environment. We've had so many guns found in Mecklenburg County schools that it's horrendous. I mean,
and what about these ghost guns now?
Oh, exactly.
I just
needs to be addressed.
I just saw on the report this morning on ghost guns in California, they confiscated 586 last year alone.
Yes. I mean, with this, it's always funny how the Republicans always throw up the Second Amendment, right? The right to bear arms.
Right.
Right. The right to establish a militia, right? And if you understand the way that was written in its original context, yeah, we were defending ourselves against the British at the time.
Right.
We were. We don't have some group coming in to invade the United States of America.
They're already here.
Exactly. Especially that the United States Navy can take care of. But we have to look at gun control. It has to be addressed. We can't just sit there and say, it is my right to bear arms. Yes, but somebody at some point in time has to answer the question, where are they getting the guns? Who's supplying them?
Well,
it has to be addressed.
Public safety
has become paramount.
I don't want to, because this is a great show, but what are going to be your top three focuses that you're going to try to get through when you become
I think my top three, of course, economic sustainability and equality across the board. That has to be addressed. The housing development situation has to be regulated, right? Education for our children, that has to be funded. We have to support our children. If we follow those basic three, and in all honesty, Mike, we have to do the fourth. We have to take care of Medicare and Medicaid. We have to support our seniors. We have to be able to provide health care and make it accessible on all levels. We have to take the money. I'm sorry, but we have to.
How much money do you think is sitting in the bank up there in the little bag?
More than I have in my back pocket, of course. But
I mean, they must have a lot of it because I understand because Biden sent it out to all the
Yes.
So it's sitting in a bag somewhere on somebody's desk or something. Okay. I mean, because they ain't earning any interest.
We have to understand the bureaucratic red tape that's set from when you go from federal to state to county to city, that whole process, right? That needs to be streamlined. And I'm not going to let it stop at the state level. If the federal government gives me a dollar, I'm giving you a dollar. All right, that's it. Now, if the county wants to take 50 cents or if the city wants to take 75,
you don't think they're going to do that?
That's on them.
Well,
but
you see,
if it comes from the federal to me, I'm getting it.
But can't you in the House direct how much each entity, agency is going to get? Or you can't?
To a certain extent, yes. We can.
And what does that mean to a certain extent? Well, I can only guide you. You can only take 2%? No, but you only take 18% or 99%.
I think our biggest problem is we sit there, we look at it and say, how much do we want to hold on to it? What do we hold on to it for? Right? I don't need a cushion. You know, I'm good.
Yeah, but your job is to get it.
My job
when
is
you
to
give
get
it down
it
here,
pass it on.
How do you tell them what to do with the money? How much money is going to go to state? I mean, a county, a city. How can you separate that? Well, I got the $18 million. I want the county to have $9 million and the city have $9 million. Can you do that?
I think from a state level, our biggest concern is what the money is going for, right? In other words, if you want to repair your roads and everything else, boom, here's your money. If you want to provide Medicare for seniors, boom.
But they're going to have to give you what they want, how much they need.
At the end of the day. It's our job to follow it by what it's designed to do. This is for infrastructure. This is for housing. This is for, you know, Medicare, Medicaid. This is for education. And this is how we raise the minimum wage. So provide the funds to allow the county and to allow the city to do the jobs that they need to do to make sure that the constituency is taken care of.
What's the minimum wage here in Mecklenburg? I mean,
on an average, the minimum wage here is $7.95.
On an average, what's that
on
mean?
An average.
What's that mean?
If you take into account all the workers that are working an hourly wage, an average, it's $7.95.
Why can't everybody get the same amount?
It's an employer issue. And it's regulated by the federal government and it's regulated by the state.
So
at the end of the day,
the
federal government says, boom, we're going to raise it to this. The state says, I want to hold it at this. And then we turn around and we say, this is where it needs to be.
Okay, suppose the federal government said, I want $15.15 an hour. And the state says, good, I want $15.15 an hour. What would that force the private companies in North Carolina to do, you think?
They'd have to step up to that $15 an hour.
Both they scream bloody murder. No, we can't. I can't do it.
We can't afford that. That's exactly what the first thing you're going to say.
So then how do you force them? Can you force them?
No, I mean, it's not a question of forcing them, right? It's a question of making them aware of the fact that we're going to provide whatever they need to sustain their business. Because we have issued small business loans to cover the cost of increasing wages for years. And we will continue to do that. We will continue to support our small businesses. But it's important for them to realize that this wage increase is necessary so we don't have the issues that we have with poverty
okay,
and running.
But doesn't the private entities, well, they say, okay, well, then I have to raise my cost of a donut to $2.75 a donut.
Yeah, and that cost gets shifted to the consumer.
And then the consumer comes in and says, well, I can't eat there anymore. Well, they can't go to the next person because the next person is going to do the same thing.
Well, you have to understand.
So they make their own donuts? So
on the other side of the coin, too, Mike, you have to understand that if I give you $15 an hour where you're getting $7 an hour, yeah, you can afford $2 a donut right now because I increased your pay by double.
Right.
So, yeah. This price is going to go up.
So the people
up,
coming
be
in
making more money,
now
so
will
be
able to pay for it.
Right.
So then why hasn't that been done? I mean, who's the one that's preventing this? I mean, I can understand the Republicans not wanting to give the money, but if everybody's going to move up the ladder, even the private entities, because they're going to have people who can afford to get these, why don't they do it?
I don't know, Michael. That's a question that needs to be addressed. It really
is it because it's hard to steal more? I mean, they need to look at Putin. Putin's been stealing from the Russian people for 20 years already.
I mean, you know, if we develop the basic attitude, you know, that a rising tide lifts all ships,
right,
then we should be able to accept the increases, right? The only problem is that we have a section of our society that has been stuck in the mud. And it's hard to get a ship out of the mud when it rises the tide. So,
okay.
You know, once we get that out of the mud, we can continue with the rise.
Now, the people that we talked about before that were put out of their homes because these guys came, wealthy people came in and bought up all their land and put them out of their homes, what are they going to do? They're not going to be able to afford this.
No.
So what do they do?
At the end of the day, we need to assess that situation to the point where we know exactly what the needs are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we need to put the programs in place. We need to develop a system that allows those people that are displaced with an opportunity to do better. Because we allow the displacement.
That's right.
So we need to be able to afford the correction. It's simple. We created the problem, let's solve it.
Well, I can understand that, but these people who are out there who are living on the street, what's going to happen to them?
The homeless issue here has been drastically under, what do I want to say, noticed.
You know,
but we see it every day. We see it every day as we're traveling back and forth to work and everything else that we're doing. We see them on the sides of the road and everything else. But to create opportunities, right? And a lot of this falls back on our educational system. A lot of this falls back on our mental health system. So if you take into account, you know, the economic sustainability, You take into account the health care issues, which include behavioral health, and you take into account the housing situation to the point where it's like these people, right, need to be put, and I hate to say it this week, but literally need to be put in a pipeline that takes them from where they are, right, gives them an opportunity not only to learn a skill, create a challenge, start something new, even a new business, provide them with the mental health that they need if it is an issue, or whatever we have rehabilitation services that they need, and educate them, connect them with the necessary companies, and create the infrastructure that we need in order to move everybody forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter, literally a matter of taking care of home. Literally. Let's take care of home for a change.
But taking care of home is, it depends on what home you're talking about. I mean, well, shouldn't the discourse not be pushed on the people that are making $500,000 a year or $500,000 a month? Shouldn't it be limited? Shouldn't this cutoff be limited? Don't we need to start finally limiting who gets the increase?
You know what? And here's the thing. Because these people that are making $500,000 a month, right, are paying less in taxes than that guy that's sitting out there on the street asking
absolutely,
for a dollar.
Absolutely right.
Right?
Right.
Yes. We need to take a look at the tax laws, and that needs to be changed. But, of course, that's the federal level. What we do on the state level, of course, needs to reflect what we do on a federal level. It does need to be addressed. It does need to be changed, and that's long overdue. But you understand, if you're making $500,000 a week or a month, right, you can make a lot of contributions into a lot of pockets that can change a lot of legislation.
You can, but will you?
But will you? That's the question. I think that, I think, you know, those issues need to be addressed, just like everything else. It's not so much, you know, of who's responsible for what, who's responsible for more, as much as it is making it even across the board, right? Now, I'm not an advocate of a flat tax, although it is possible that could correct the problem. But at the end of the day, I think everybody needs to pay their fair share. They do.
Everybody should pay their fair share. Okay, so but you're going to have to put people in place because you can't do this by yourself. You always have to have people doing things. How are you going to look for the people that are going to help you put this in place?
Every once in a while, you got to sit down with somebody and talk to them face to face, Mike. You got to find out what their core values are. Those are the people that you reject, or those are the people that you select. But you got to know. You got to do it face to face. Yeah, it's going to take a while. It's going to take a minute. But at the end of the day, you get the right team in the right place, and you can move mountains.
Well, that's true. But getting to that point could take some time. And don't you need to get running right away?
Well, I want to start this now. I do. But I'm thinking by my second and third term, I'll have it down pat.
Well, that's good. Second and third term. All right. So when is the primary?
The primary for this election cycle is May 17th. And the general is going to be in November. So this is an odd year, and everybody needs to keep this in mind. We have every office running in this primary.
Every office in the state?
We have U.S. Congress.
Wow.
We have the U.S. Senate. We have the House of Representatives.
That very seldom happens.
I know, it never happens. We have not only your county commissions, but we also have your city council members that are running. So it's a full-blown slate.
Running?
The governor is not.
So the governor and the president are only one of them running.
I know, right? But, and of course, whatever you do, don't forget your judges. 9 times out of 10,
hey,
they're going to be on the tail end of your ballot. And
now, this is something. This is my peak. And I've been saying this ever since I've been here. In 95, been a Democrat in Mecklenburg County. Why aren't the judges the first person you vote for on the ballot?
You know, that's a Board of Election question and a Board of Election decision. But in
I
my
think
mind,
the House passed a law that had to be like that.
In my mind, I think that needs to be addressed.
Because you see a judge quicker than you see a city councilman or a governor.
Nine times out of ten.
Well, you got some people down here and the judges that, hey, they're wacko. Completely, you need to get rid of them. But if you don't make them down at the bottom, people don't ever vote for them.
Yeah.
I mean, you got 5 million people voting for the President of the United States and two people voting for a judge. Yeah. What, are you kidding me? Something's wrong here.
Yeah. They need as much attention as we do.
Absolutely.
They need as much attention.
So how can they get in touch with you if people want to add to your campaign or?
Okay.
My
website is votej112.com. I kept it simple. Votej112.com. It'll give you insight into me, my character, my background. It'll give you my platform. You can go on and you can take a look at it. And, yeah, go ahead and write that check. Go ahead and do that donation.
Okay.
And I appreciate your support, and I look forward to representing you in the upcoming General Assembly.
Okay. Now, are there many people running for this spot?
There's a total of four of us running for this spot.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a total of four people running for this spot.
Okay. Well, Jay's the only one you got to remember who's running. Forget everybody else. And they got one guy running this contest that's a complete moron that I won't mention his name now, but, you know, M is his last initial, his last name. But anyway, I will, that's me saying that. No, that's not Jay. All right, everybody. VoteJ112.com is our phone number. They can get to it.
Oh, call me directly.
Call them directly.
Call me directly. 704-670-6490.
Okay.
Call me directly.
All right. And as the episode was said, there's no business like the open. And
There's no business like show business, I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you opened and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they hung a star. Let's go on with the show. The costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props. The audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops. The sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come. Word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. And top of that, your pa and I have parted. You're broken hearted, but you go on. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Even with a turkey that you know.